Richard Dawkins is the professor of the public understanding of science at the University of Oxford. He was earlier a zoologist and worked again in Oxford, and he has become very famous, not so much as a professor for the public understanding of science, but as someone who propagates atheism very vociferously. And the reason that we're having a seminar entitled God and Richard Dawkins is not that Richard Dawkins is the only prominent scientific figure talking about atheism, but he is one of the most influential in terms of his book output and in terms of his media appearances, and also in terms of the influence he has on the younger generation, and not only the younger generation, because I constantly meet many people who feel that his work has settled the matter of God for them permanently. And indeed, the title of the seminar is essentially the same as the title of this book, which has recently appeared by Blackwell in Oxford by Professor Alistair McGrath, called Dawkins' God. Alistair McGrath is a molecular biologist turned theologian and is now the Professor of Historical Theology at Oxford, and he has an output of about 50 books, and you can add to that research papers as well. And so it is very interesting to see the way in which he approaches the work of Richard Dawkins. And I'm going to talk for a while and then throw it open for questions and discussion. You will find most, but not all, of what I say in McGrath's book, and we'll see where we take it then in the discussion afterwards. And what I've listed on these pages are a number of areas where Richard Dawkins interacts with God and with religion. And the first of these areas is the relationship between science and religion. And Dawkins claims that the alleged convergence between religion and science is a shallow, empty, spin-doctored sham. Now, that, of course, is a claim. And as a claim, it is subject to testing. And it is worthwhile doing a bit of serious examination to see whether this is the case. First of all, it cannot be as simple as Richard Dawkins suggests. Firstly, there is an array of highly distinguished scientists who feel that at bottom there is no conflict between science and religion. I recall well the words of Sir Lawrence Bragg, who said science and religion are opposed, just as the fingers and the thumb are opposed, so that between them we may grasp everything. And Sir Gillian Prance, a fellow of the Royal Society, as Richard Dawkins is, and arguably the most distinguished plant scientist of the 20th century, says that he became a Christian at Oxford, and all his studies in science since he was a student confirm his faith. And in addition, he regards the Bible as his supreme authority. And the very fact that there is a number of very distinguished scientists who do not see an essential conflict between science and faith in God shows that there is something shallow about Richard Dawkins' analysis. And indeed, that will be seen very readily if we do a little bit of historical research. Very often, Dawkins' view is bolstered by two incidents in history, the famous Galileo affair and his condemnation by the Roman Catholic Church, and secondly, the more recent debate in Oxford on the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, the debate between Huxley and Wilberforce. And one of the interesting things about those two debates is that more recent historical research has completely undermined their viability as stories to support the so-called conflict metaphor between science and religion. So much so that the professor of the history of science at the Open University in England, Professor Colin Russell, says the common belief that the actual relations between religion and science over the last few centuries have been marked by deep and enduring hostility is not only historically inaccurate, but actually caricature so grotesque that what needs to be explained is how it could possibly have achieved any degree of respectability. And the kind of thing that Colin Russell is referring to is the kind of work that people like Professor John Brooke, who's the professor of science and religion in Oxford, have done on those events. After all, if you look at the story of Galileo, even a superficial look will show you that what he was protesting against was a worldview, the Aristotelian worldview that placed the earth at the center with everything else revolving around. And that worldview was believed by most of his contemporaries, not only the members of the Roman Catholic Church, so that in fact he was attacked by the philosophers just as much as the church people. Secondly, Galileo was not the wisest of men. When he published his book on the two world systems, he put the views of the current Pope into the mouth of a figure whom he called Simplicio, the fool. And that did not exactly endear him to the powers of the day. Galileo was no atheist. He believed in Scripture before and through and at the end of his discussions and trials with the Roman Catholic Church. And the interesting thing to my mind about Galileo actually is this, that he was criticizing a reigning scientific paradigm while remaining a believer. There are shades of that going on today, which we may come back to a little bit later. Huxley and Wilberforce is a similar story. When you investigate it, it doesn't bear the weight that is put on it, because it's often represented as an incompetent bishop, Wilberforce, against the brilliant scientist T.H. Huxley. And Huxley won. Well, that's the story that Huxley and his friends put around. But the records of the event at the time say explicitly that the feeling was that both sides were roughly equal. The interesting thing is that there are records of what Wilberforce actually wrote in his critique of Darwin's Origin of Species. And I've read it myself. It's about 50 pages long. And the fascinating thing about it is there's very little religious-type argument in it at all. In fact, near the beginning, he says, I will eschew, that is, I will reject arguments from religious premises. I want to deal with Darwin on scientific basis of argument. So there again, you see, it wasn't an ignorant non-scientist being slain by a brilliant scientist. In fact, Wilberforce showed himself to be a very competent amateur scientist. And Darwin's comment on Wilberforce's paper was that it was uncommonly brilliant because it had perceived all the weaknesses in my theory. Social analysis and political analysis of the events of that time show that in addition to the intellectual confrontation, there was another agenda, that was that Huxley was attempting to gain supremacy for scientists, professional scientists, as distinct from amateurs, very many of which had hitherto been clergymen in the Church of England. So that this story again, and Professor Brooke has analyzed it in one of his books, doesn't bear the weight that's put on it. It doesn't prove that there's a massive conflict between science and belief in God at all. And the striking thing is that Dawkins appears to be ignorant of the historical research that has been done on this topic, because he does not even mention it. So that's one area, the relationship of science to religion. We might add to that that my impression is that Richard Dawkins has forgotten the roots of modern science. And this seems to be a very important element in our engagement with this topic. Where does the sudden surge in science in the 16th and 17th century come from? What is its origin? Well, let me read to you what Melvin Calvin says about it. He won the Nobel Prize for biochemistry. As I try to discern the origin of the conviction, that is, that the universe is orderly, I seem to find it in a basic notion discovered 2,000 or 3,000 years ago and enunciated first in the Western world by the ancient Hebrews, namely, that the universe is governed by a single God and is not the product of the whims of many gods, each governing his own province according to his own laws. This monotheistic view seems to be the historical foundation for modern science. Now, that is highly significant, and it's very easy for us to forget it in the contemporary debate, because this is a thesis that can easily be lost sight of. You see, even in philosophy, if you think of the way philosophy is taught in our schools and universities, it usually goes back to the ancient Greeks. Well, actually, the ancient Hebrews predated the ancient Greeks. And it is a mistake, and it actually disorientates us in our philosophical context not to go back even further. Because, of course, the Hebrew worldview preceded the Greek worldview, and the Hebrew worldview tells us that this universe is created by a God who transcends space and time. And it is that worldview that was behind the meteoric rise of science in the 16th and 17th centuries. Now, this is something I think that we need to discuss with people and tell them. It is often called Whitehead's thesis. Sir Alfred North Whitehead was one of the greatest historians of science and philosophers of science. He worked with Bertrand Russell on the Principia Mathematica. And he, in one of his books, observed that medieval Europe in 1500 knew less than Archimedes in the 3rd century BC. And yet, by 1700, Newton had written his masterpiece, the Principia Mathematica. And Whitehead said, how do you get such a rapid expansion of scientific knowledge in just 200 years? And his answer is this, I quote, modern science must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God. My explanation is that the faith in the possibility of science was generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory is an unconscious derivative from medieval theology. That's in his famous book, Science and the Modern World. C.S. Lewis...
Could you read that again?
Yes, I can read that again. Modern science must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God. My explanation is that the faith in the possibility of science generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory is an unconscious derivative from medieval theology. C.S. Lewis puts it much more succinctly. He says, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. And it was that conviction that led Francis Bacon, who is regarded by many as the father of contemporary science, to teach that God has provided us with two books, the book of nature and the Bible, and that to be really properly educated, one should give one's mind to studying both. Now, Dawkins fails to mention this, and it seems to be in the science-religion debate, it's a very good thing to bring it into play, because what we're talking about here is not the detail of science, but the history of science. And that is just as important, because we can even we can easily get lost in detail, but the history is there and gives us a powerful basis on which to question Dawkins' thesis here. And I needn't list to you some of the great names at the time, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, and so on, who were all believers in God. So the history of science seems to dispute Dawkins' claim that the alleged convergence between religion and science is a shallow, empty, spin-doctored sham. Before we go on to the second point, I'd just like to say that the effect of this is quite serious. It shifts the focus away from the real problem. And the real problem, it seems to me, is not an alleged conflict between science and religion, although it must be said, and let me say it now in case I forget, that there have been occasions when believers in God have not exactly supported the cause of science. We mustn't think it all goes in one direction. But Whitehead's thesis is essentially valid. The problem with Dawkins' thesis is, saying science and religion are at war with each other, is that it bypasses the central issue. And the central issue is this. We have essentially three worldviews. And the real question that lies behind this is a worldview question. Let me put it very simply to you. Either the material world is an illusion or it is not. If it is an illusion, you have the Far Eastern family of worldviews like Hinduism and Buddhism and so on. If the material world is real, we have two possibilities. Either it is real and it is all that there is, in which case we've got materialism, or it is real and it is not all that there is. There is a creator and we have theism. Now, this is a pretty crude generalization, but I found it helpful as a grid to focus discussion. Now, here we have science. And the essential question is, with which of these worldviews does science sit most comfortably? You see, what Dawkins is saying is that science is at war here. But actually, what I would claim, and we can see, does this claim make sense as we go on a little bit? I would claim that Dawkins is sitting in this position here as a materialist. And of course, by definition, he's involved in this conflict. That's clear. There is a real conflict. But it's a conflict between his metaphysical presuppositions. The real question, though, is this, if we want to bring science into it, does science sit most comfortably there, or does it sit most comfortably here? This issue here doesn't come up with Dawkins at all. It will come up with other people, but it doesn't come up with Dawkins. So I think the way we need to refocus the question is, does science as we understand it sit most comfortably with materialism, or does it sit with theism? I don't intend to give a lecture on that now. I've given many others elsewhere. But that's where the real tension is. And underlying all of his works is the tension between theism and atheism, materialistic atheism. And what Dawkins claims is that his antagonism to God is flowing from his science, when actually I would want to argue it's flowing from his metaphysics. It's flowing from his underlying philosophical worldview. And I found that a helpful way to get into the discussion. The next thing, number two, is Dawkins' concept of faith. It's not only Dawkins' concept of faith, because in my recent days in Oxford, I've been talking to quite a number of colleagues in science, asking them what they think faith means. And I am astonished to discover just how many of them agree with Richard Dawkins. His concept of faith is blind trust in the absence of evidence, even in the teeth of evidence. And he regards faith as a mental illness, comparable to the smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate. Now, this is utterly fascinating, because you only have to look at any lexical aid, a dictionary, or consult any sensible theologian, or look up the meaning of the Greek words used in the New Testament and the Hebrew words used in the Old Testament, to discover that there is no evidence whatsoever for Dawkins' definition. Now, in many of his books, Dawkins says, and quite rightly, that we ought to test everything on the basis of evidence. There's one famous place where he says, if anybody comes to you with a theory, ask them what evidence they have to support it. So I would simply want to turn that question on him himself. What evidence is there that you will give to support the notion that faith in God, that is a response based on absence of evidence? And it would seem, and Alistair McGrath points it out very trenchantly in his book, it would seem that Dawkins has not interacted with any serious theologian at all, because his view of faith is false. Now, this is a very important topic, not simply for us to see that his notions of faith are false, but that many other people have got at least part of this idea into their heads, so it's very difficult for them to begin to perceive that our faith in God is something that can be discussed in the public arena. Because for them, faith is something that is privatized. You believe that, you've no evidence for it, of course, so no wonder you don't want to talk about it. But the moment you begin to, as I find at least, the moment you begin to bring your faith in God out into the public arena, you find these people get very nervous, because their concept of faith is something that you don't bring into the public arena, because it's not evidence-based, and therefore it doesn't have any place at the table of public debate. And so I think this is an important one. I'm still battling away in my own college at Oxford, got one or two people on my side, but not many yet, to get across the notion that faith is evidence-based in the New Testament, that is. And that is obvious from the way in which the term is used. For example, in the Gospel of John, at the end of the Gospel of John, John says, gives us his reason for writing his book. These things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. These things are written. Here's the evidence on which you can base faith. Paul, when he confronted the philosophers at Athens, mentioned the resurrection of Christ as evidence to all, not just to believers. It's the other way round. It was evidence to all. In other words, it was set forward as something historical that they could get their intellectual teeth into and on which they could base their faith. So this is enormously important. Now, the next step is to get across the notion that faith, at some level, is involved in science. Now, I am aware, as you are aware, that faith in a person is somewhat different from faith in a proposition, but not different in the sense that they don't both involve evidence. I hope that your trust in your wife or husband is based on evidence, and in our friends, But it is a much more sophisticated kind of multidimensional evidence than the kind of intellectual evidence that we need for faith in a proposition. But nonetheless, both of these things are evidence-based. In science, we have that notion, and Dawkins appears to share it, for what reason I don't know, that there is no faith involved in science. And it seems to me that it is very important there to point out the thing that's so obvious that many scientists fail to see it at all, that one presupposition of scientific activity is, first of all, to believe that there is a universe out there that you can study, and secondly, and more importantly, a belief in the rational intelligibility or the mathematical intelligibility of that universe. And of course, it is obvious as a matter of logic that physics cannot prove to you, or mathematics, that the universe is rationally intelligible. As John Polkinghorne points out, he tried to teach me quantum physics at Cambridge many years ago, he points out that science is powerless to explain its faith in the rational intelligibility of the universe, simply because you can't do any physics unless you believe it in the first place. So that faith is essential to the scientific endeavor. Now again, notice I'm not arguing details of science. I find in the whole apologetics debate, people are far too quick to come to the details of science. They forget the history of science, the philosophy of science, and the methodology of science, and therefore their argument is concentrated on bits of science. They may be extremely important, but if you concentrate there, you miss an enormous amount of the weight of the argument itself. And just, well, it's not really part of this talk, but I'll point it out anyway. We can ask ourselves, on the basis of faith in the rational intelligibility of the universe, which of these two worldviews does science sit with most comfortably, materialism or atheism? The materialism is reductionist, so that rationality must be explained bottom-up in terms of matter and energy, but then, as Haldane pointed out long ago, if the thoughts in my brain are simply the result of the random motions of atoms in my head, why should I believe those thoughts? In fact, why should I believe that my brain is composed of atoms in the first place? It has a subtle habit of collapsing, whereas, on the theistic view, the reason the universe is rationally intelligible is the God who is there created the universe outside of me as well as the brain and mind inside of me. And therefore, it's not surprisingly that we have at least some limited access to the nature of the universe. So faith is involved in science, and there's a lot of work to be done to get that across, because it is a brilliant defense mechanism, it seems to me, on the part of the atheists to privatize faith, to redefine it, and therefore to render it impotent. And in order to dialogue with Dawkins' kind of thinking, we need to bring that out and point out that it's simply wrong-headed. Then there's the concept of explanation. Notice these are all fundamental things. The nature of explanation. And Richard Dawkins self-evidently thinks of God as competing with scientific explanation. Here's a phenomenon. How do you explain it? It's either science or God. But that's actually absurd and commits what philosophers call a category mistake. Let me illustrate it perhaps by quoting Laplace to you. You remember when Napoleon had his famous discussion with Laplace about la mécanique céleste, and looking at these marvelous equations for ballistics, and Napoleon said, "Where is God in your book?" And the famous reply came, "Je n'ai pas besoin de cette hypothèse." I do not need that hypothesis. Laplace was perfectly right, of course, wasn't he? Because what he was describing in his book was how the universe worked. And to describe how it works in terms of mathematics, you don't mention God. I don't mention God if I'm giving a lecture in the university on the law of gravity. But if Napoleon had asked the question, how is it that there's a universe in which these laws are obeyed? That's a different question, isn't it? You see, we need to look at the category of the question. That is a very important thing. And then we need to make another distinction, and that is the distinction between mechanism and agency. So many arguments, and Dawkins uses one in The Blind Watchmaker, go like this. We have a mechanism. It does X. And in particular, he refers to the mechanism of natural selection and mutation, the putative evolutionary mechanism. Okay, well, think of any mechanism. We have done a mechanism and it does this, therefore God doesn't exist. That's putting it crudely, but that's what it amounts to. But you see, that is to make a category mistake. The existence of a mechanism does not imply in itself that there is no agent who made the mechanism. The existence of a mechanism, an engine that drives a Ford car, and you understand it completely, is not an argument for disbelieving in the existence of Mr. Ford, who originally designed the car, is it? But often that category mistake is made. We have a mechanism, therefore there is no God. You see, when Newton formulated his laws of motion, he didn't say, marvelous, we now know how it works, we don't need God. He actually said the opposite. Isn't it such a sophisticated system with these laws that he worshipped God all the more? You see, the existence of a mechanism, in that case gravity, and an inverse square law, is not an argument in itself against the existence of someone who created the mechanism. Now, that's such a simple argument, and it lies on the surface of things, and yet very often it is not perceived at all. Richard Swinburne's quote is very useful here. I've recorded it for you. I'm not postulating God of the gaps, God merely to explain the things that science has not yet explained. I'm postulating God to explain why science explains. I do not deny that science explains, but I postulate God to explain why science explains. Then the fourth thing, very briefly, is related to what I've just said. Can we deduce atheism from biology? And the famous core statement of the blind watchmaker is the one I've recorded down here, that the only watchmaker is the blind forces of physics, albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight, he designs his cogs and springs, and plans their interconnections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered, and which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind, it has no mind and no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future, it has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker. Now, one of the important things to notice in this is the rhetoric of the argument. It's very clever, actually. But let's try and disassociate itself from evolution and just see what the argument's actually saying. He's talking about processes that are blind and automatic. What does that mean? Let me illustrate it to you. Suppose I have in my hand a self-winding watch. It is blind. It actually doesn't have a mind. It is automatic. If I follow Dawkins' argument, it is not designed. But you see what he's done. He's used the words blind and automatic of the process and subtly expected you to transform them in your mind, to transfer them in your mind to any possible agency that might have been behind the process, but those are two separate things. You see, you can say that, in fact, most machines, that computer, It's blind. It's automatic. It has no mind. But it was designed, wasn't it? Because the question of whether a mechanism is designed or not has nothing to do with its description in terms of terminology like blind, automatic, no mind, and so forth and so forth. You see? And many people miss that, and they think that Dawkins has therefore argued away intelligence agency when, in fact, he has not addressed the subject at all. And it's best to be very aware of that when you are reading his arguments. Now, the next step, and this could lead to a very long lecture, and it won't, I promise you, I'm going to stop in a moment, is to point out why the argument that I have just used is found to be inadequate by people like Richard Dawkins. And this is exceedingly important. Suppose we say, and I chose a self-winding watch for this reason, that here is something that uses a certain amount of randomness. Yes, the random motions of my arm wind the thing up, actually. So it involves randomness. So here's the putative evolutionary mechanism. It involves randomness, mutation, and it involves, according to Dawkins, a law-like process of natural selection. So it's chance and necessity. We got that here. That's not an argument against it being designed, as I've just said. But what I discovered is this. When you use that argument, that is the logic category philosophical argument, the answer you will get, perhaps from Dawkins, certainly from Dan Dennett, who's explicit about it, is, but you see, you do not understand then what we're claiming. It's obvious you don't understand it. Because what we are claiming is that we have a mechanism that designs without itself needing to be designed. And if you don't take that on board, it shows that you have completely failed to understand what the central issue is. So it seems to me that there are two levels of arguments that are necessary here. You see, here is B for biology or D for Darwinism. In the sense of the modern synthesis, and I'm thinking over only of the macro synthesis. I don't think any of us have any difficulty with the fact that natural selection and mutation produce certain differences. Just look around the room if you don't believe that. I'm talking about the macro level. Darwinism implies atheism. That is what Dawkins claims. And we should be alerted to the fact that that's very unlikely to be true, because at the left-hand side, this is a science, at least a putative science, and at this side, it's a worldview, it's a philosophy. These are in a different category to start with, and it's just worthwhile pointing that out. It's so obvious, again, that people miss it. But, you see, in order for that to be valid, that implication, you would have to be able to establish two simultaneously valid propositions. And the first of them is that evolution is incompatible with the existence of a creator. I have tried to argue that in terms of mechanism, that it isn't. But you'd simultaneously have to argue that evolutionary theory can bear the weight that is put on it. Because if it can't bear the weight that's put on it, it does not an argument, is it? And so that is a legitimate question, but I want to point out that it's a scientific question. Can the theory put the weight that's support the weight that's put on it? Now, the weight that's put on it, according to Dawkins, in this quote, if you notice, is, we now know that evolution, or natural selection and so on, is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life. So it's the existence question. He's claiming its existence and shape. Well, let's allow, for the sake of argument, that these sort of microevolutionary processes do affect the shape, affect my shape. Does it account for the existence of life? Now, if they claim that I do not understand the mechanism because they are claiming it's a mechanism that designs without having been designed, then it seems to me, and I know others disagree with me, but it seems to me important then to ask, does this mechanism actually bear that weight? Does it bear that weight? And Dawkins attempts to show that it does, and we had an illustration of that this morning. Charles Thaxton mentioned the famous "me thinks it is like a weasel" argument that is Dawkins' attempt, and I admire him for this. He actually does try to give us a scenario where things are made possible, and he attempts to show you how you can reduce the number of generations in which to produce a desired result, or increase the probabilities, whichever way you want to look at it, by having a group of monkeys typing, as you saw, and they aim for a target phrase. And the idea is that the monkey types, and whenever it hits the right letter in the target phrase, that letter is held to the end. Well, that's marvelous. I would like to paraphrase Dawkins. He talks about things being apparently designed. I would want to say that this is an apparent generator of information. But it doesn't generate any information, because the probability that you reach the target is 1, the information generated is 0, and what he has done to solve the problem is built the answer into the machine to start with. The machine already has the informational content that you need to produce the answer. In other words, his machine fulfills precisely the conditions for the algorithmic theorem of Gregory Chaitin, the IBM computer genius, who proved that no Turing machine, that is, no machine that simulates any computer, theoretical or otherwise, can generate information that is not already in its own informational structure or in its input, that is in accord with it precisely. And it shows that actually Dawkins' solution proves the exact opposite of what he claims. He cannot generate this phrase without an intelligently designed mechanism. So it seems to me that at the heart of the actual mechanism that he brings to bear on it, there is a colossal logical flaw, because it involves the very information to start with that he claims to be generating, and he just factors a little bit of randomness in. My final point is the complexity of God argument that Dawkins is famous for and many people are using these days. I mentioned it in my pre-forum seminar, which not all of you were at. The complexity of God argument goes like this. To mention God at any stage is to give a non-explanation, because God, by definition, is the most complex being there is. So any phenomenon that you're going to ultimately trace to God is, by definition, less complex than the God that you're using as the explanation. So it's not an explanation at all. That's what I call the complexity of God argument. It sounds very impressive, doesn't it? But it is nonsense, in fact. And I usually illustrate it by my Chinese archaeologist. So we're in a cave in southern China, you see, and the archaeologist takes me into the cave, and on the wall she sees two scratches like this. And she says, "Human intelligence." And I say, "Don't be absurd. What an absurd explanation of two scratches. Do you mean that you think it's an explanation for this to postulate something as complex as a human brain?" This is, as I understand it, the symbol Han, which means a human being. And she just laughs at me and she says, "Don't you understand semiotics? That these symbols carry meaning. And because they carry meaning, the immediate inference is upwards to a more complex origin, not downwards." That's very interesting, isn't it? They're just two scratches. Immediately we make an inference upwards and not downwards. I'll finish the story, although it's not directly relevant to this. She then magically transforms herself into a molecular biologist. And we go into the laboratory, and she shows me down an electron microscope. And under the microscope, you see something like this, you see. And it's not actually written on it, but you know what I mean. And I say, what's that? The human genome. Aha. Yes, what is that? Well, it's a four-letter alphabet and so on. There are 3.5 billion of those in exactly the right order, those letters. And I say to her, how did that come to be? And she says, chance and necessity. I said, pardon? Just a few minutes ago we were in the cave and we got 2 scratches as far as I can remember. And you said, intelligence. And now you look at this. It strikes me as a bit curious, that, doesn't it? The New Testament claims that it is possible to perceive that there is a God from the created world, and that people are without excuse for failing to see it. That's quite strong language, isn't it? And I suspect our scientists may be the more responsible because they've been allowed to see more deeply into the brilliantly sophisticated aspects of the creation. But let's not forget, we do not just recognize God in these areas where we postulate intelligence because of the semiotic type structure that we're seeing. We also look at the glory of God in the heavens, something that's open to everybody to understand. And it's the whole show, not only the little details, that give evidence that there is a God. Richard Dawkins is a brilliant writer. I envy him his writing powers. Superb writer. But I fear myself that there are certain fundamental misunderstandings in his book. The final one I just mentioned briefly is his notion of simplicity. He wants to, reductionism, you see, is explain the complex in terms of the simple. You need to be careful with that. I have not found that quantum electrodynamics is particularly simple. I don't know about you. Quantum mechanics itself, nobody knows why it works. It's not simple. As Einstein pointed out, things should be simple, but only as simple as makes sense. The reason people believe in quantum theory is not because it's simple. It's because of its explanatory power. And one of the criteria of truth is explanatory power. And we need to be careful of that. You see, the reason that my Chinese archaeologist believes that human intelligence is responsible for that, well, there's a whole host of reasons. But it's the only explanation, even though it's in terms of a complex brain that we don't begin to understand, it's the only explanation that makes sense. It's got the explanatory power. It is for the same reason that I, ladies and gentlemen, believe that this here ultimately is to be explained in terms of intelligence. You notice I use the word ultimately. That's important. Because, you see, there are 2 issues, not one. I can look at this. If I've never seen it before and somebody shows me the complex language-like structure of the codons arranged on the double helix of DNA, I mightn't have a notion what sort of mechanism produced that, but that shouldn't stop me recognizing that it is ultimately a product of intelligence. Yep. Well, thank you very much. I've gone on. I don't know how long I'm supposed to go on for, so I've gone on for a finite time. Let's have some discussion and questions. Oh, no, that's all right. It's time we had some discussion. Ooh. Yes. Yes, I can tell you're from Eastern Europe, sir. Apophatic and cataphatic methods of knowing God. What would I say about it? Well, the apophatic way, as I understand it, is emphasizing what God isn't, and points out that God ultimately is a great mystery, and we cannot ultimately get to know God. You cannot say, if anything, this is God, because you'd have to say, well, not exactly that, not this, not that, not that. That is the apophatic way. Now, in one of its emphases, I sympathize with it. That is, we are creatures, God is the creator. And therefore, we shall never be able to exhaustively know God. The danger with it, though, is this, that taken to its logical conclusion, it denies the basic assertions of Christianity. Let me illustrate what I mean by that. One of the things that is central to the gospel is that man, by his own capacity, cannot get to know God, but God has revealed himself. 1 John, these things are written that you might know. This is eternal life, that you might know God and him who God has sent. And the danger of extrapolating the apophatic method, and I've seen this, talk to people about it, where you'd end up saying, well, if you are to say that God is Jesus Christ, that cannot be so, because God cannot be ultimately identified anywhere. So you have to then say, not that. That, to my mind, is a denial of the actual fundamental claim of Christianity. So it seems to me there is an emphasis that's healthy. We can't completely get to know God. But if Scripture, on which I base my life and the presuppositions of my life, if Scripture claims that we can get to know God, then I need to watch before I adopt a theology that's actually moving in the opposite direction, you see. So the cataphatic side of it, one would want to emphasize that God is revealing himself. Of course I will never know him as I should do. One day, Paul tells me, and I believe him, I shall know even as I have been known. So that would be my response to that. One side to keep one humble, but the other side, this vastly encouraging thing that we can get to know God. Thank you. Yes. You can come back to the typing ape with great pleasure. You feel sympathetic to typing apes, do you, Alexander?
No.
Ah, yes. Well, the question is that Richard Dawkins might reply that the information, the position of the M, the E, and so on is given by the environment. I think, Alexander, my reaction to that when it's been brought up in discussion with me is to say, but all you are doing is telling you that the environment has that full set of information at a level. The environment now has all that information built into it. If the environment is controlling it, and where does the environment get that detailed information? It doesn't seem to me that that solves the problem at all. I mean, if you have some kind of evolutionary algorithm, which is all this is mathematically, of course, wherever the target comes from, the claim is that the information is already in the system. And I understand you to be saying precisely that, except it's in the environment. And all this is doing is clawing it out of the environment. It doesn't seem to me to alter the problem one slight bit. Yes?
I don't think you've quite answered the point. Well,
I may not have done.
It may be that the M is not in the environment, but it may be that the M is intrinsically the M the yes, which will satisfy the environment. So it's not that the information is there, it's that the M the
I'm not sure that I see the difference, but perhaps you can help me. Because if that is true for the sequence of the order in which it appears, it seems to me you're simply saying all the information is already sitting there in all its vast complexity. Is that what you're saying?
I think I'm distinguishing between the information being there in the environment and being suitable for that information.
Yeah, well, that may be true, but I'm not sure that it's solving the informational problem. But
I'm just exploring.
Yeah, well, sure. I'm very happy to explore. Yes.
If the environment is only suitable for that sequence of events, the environment doesn't have to know that. The information doesn't have to be there. It may just intrinsically.
Yeah, well, that's what's bothering me, you see. I think possibly logically that there is a separation, but I'm not sure that it's helping deal with the probability question. Yes? Well, that's just the same problem,
yeah.
It seems to me. It's the same problem, we're just reformulating the setting. Right, we'll let you then come. Alexander, you want to come back at that? Only two what? Oh, tomatoes. Yeah, sorry, I'm from England. My linguistic powers don't stretch to tomatoes. Tomatoes. We got two tomatoes, yes?
There's a bacterium that within itself has mutation potential and can vary from different styles of nourishment.
Yes.
So the information of how to get nourishment from tomatoes is not in the environment, but it needs to be found out by the bacterium and by a blind mutation.
Yes.
But it will only remain different kinds of outlets to get nourishment from tomatoes. And that's
so it's a 1 in 2 chance of getting it right. In your case. It's a 1 in 2 chance of getting it right. Is that right? In your case. Yes.
Received from tomatoes. And this is the reason why you think the tomatoes in there remains the only possible result. But it's not because this is contained in the environment.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that, but it seems to me that doesn't alter the situation at all, because when you accumulate these, the probabilities are going to be exactly the same in your model or this model or mine. I don't see how that alters it. Perhaps we'd better go into this over a cup of coffee or something. Yes, what did you want to say? Oh, well, we'll try and save you, brother. I mean, we'll try and help you as best we can. Could I define what is meant by them?
Yes, because I wasn't exactly sure what I should understand by science.
Well, that's a very sharp question, you know. And even the best philosophers can't answer you. We all know what we mean by both of these things until we try to define them. And it's one of those situations which is curious. And there are books by the hundred attempting to define what science is and what the scientific method is, and so on. Starting with the schoolboy notion that science is the result of observation, experimentation, setting up a hypothesis, testing it, and so on. And that sounds good, all those words we associate with doing science. But it's very difficult to get a precise definition. That doesn't mean that we can say nothing about it, because it's like so many concepts, to get a precise notion of what it is very difficult. But there are enough working definitions So if we're thinking of the area of investigation of the universe in terms of, at the first level, doing experiments, observations, etc., etc., we would then split into two. The one would be things that you can repeat in the lab. I tell you, if you take this compound and that compound and put them together and heat them, you'll get this result. You can do it tomorrow. Somebody else can do it the next day and can confirm that what we claim is true. That is the kind of science that involves repeated confirmation. But there then is what is more aptly described as historical science. That is where we are trying to get access to things that by definition cannot be repeated, like the whole history of the universe, for example. And if you were to restrict yourself simply to science in terms of repeated observation experiment, it would cut a lot of people out of work, the cosmologists for a start, and a lot of biology of the sort that we're talking about. So there what you have to do is use inference to the best explanation. In other words, you start off saying, well, if it was like this, if A is true, B would follow. We observe B, so A is likely. But you can't give it the same kind of authority as you can give to something that you confirm by repeated experiment, like the fact that the Earth is rotating in an orbit around the sun. Now, the other side of that, the God question, the religious question, is simply asking, what is the status of the universe that we observe? Is it self-existent? Is it all that there is? Or is it created? Is there a supreme being who creates it? That's usually what's referred to by religion in this context. We're not thinking of a particular religion. We're simply thinking of the question, is there a God behind it or not? Does that make sense to you now? Good. Yes. Yes, sorry, it was you.
You mentioned about pre-competition and it
seems
to me that it's often involved in the country.
Yes.
I remember seeing a video that was talking about three things happened by chance. You said, no, it would be my turn, and I said, I'm getting sick. That's fine. But then he said, plus, given a little bit of luck,
yes. My response to that would be to point out that not only Dawkins, but anybody else I know, has given up a purely chance explanation of the origin of life. The whole point of the me thinks it is like a weasel analogy is to argue that chance won't do it. And he says himself that we can believe in luck, but not that much luck. And he and atheists like Isaac Asimov, for example, have just completely given it up because it's very simple to calculate, you see, that random chance doesn't do it. So what do you introduce? You introduce something law-like. And the key idea here is that the law-likeness comes from the natural selection. The randomness comes from the mutation. You see, so the natural selection bit that he has built in, I'm trying to argue, is actually an intelligently designed thing. So he's got those two things working together. There's something random happening, the typing, but then there's something law-like happening. There's something zeroing in on this. On the point on the philosophy, I'm afraid I am not impressed with Dawkins' philosophy. It's his philosophy that I think lets him down tragically, apart altogether from the validity of the science. So that's all I can say about that. Yes, please, Adam.
I'm very like this theorem about the computer that you mentioned.
Chaitin's theorem, yes?
Yeah. And, you know, there's very often such an argument given to Christian, I mean, that information or something. that, for example, if you will build a very intelligent way, let's say many connection of electronic connection or something, eventually you can come to some kind of intellect or the other, which is shortly given to the opportunity, where they say if you will just send in the internet many letters, many just somehow even sporadically, but they couldn't build something new information inside the net somehow.
Yes.
Could we apply this theorem which you mentioned to say that it's not possible just to produce some meaningful information out of such chaotic?
Oh, there's a marvelous program you can access on the web. I hope you've all tried it. Have you tried it? The monkey generating program? It's marvelous. And it's been going for years. You can see it going. You just access this, type into the internet, monkeys typing Shakespeare. And you get this marvelous window that comes up where they've been typing for, it's a simulation, of course, so they've been typing for billions of years. And the record is that they got three words of one of Shakespeare's plays. And so it's tremendous fun. You can see it actually going on in front of you. That's an example of this. It's super. It's great fun. Yes? Chance is a word that's used for several different concepts. In fact, alas, like all of life, it's a little bit more complicated. There's chance in the sense that what's the probability that the die will land one or a six and so on, one and six on average with an unloaded dice, you see. But then there's chance in a quantum mechanical sense, where there's an element of total unpredictability. You see, when I spin a die, that chance is really a measure of my ignorance. But if I knew all the actual parameters, I could calculate which way it would land, you see? It's a measure of ignorance. In quantum mechanics, it's an essential unpredictability. But then there's a third meaning of the word chance, and that is absence of design. The window broke by chance. And the problem is often that those three are all confused. Let me give you a simple example of this. We get a statistician who watches me drive to work and sits to see what days I go into work and formulates some statistical survey of it and calculates that there's one chance in three that I will go to work on a Friday, right? This isn't a moral class in moral philosophy. You ought to have been in the track on moral philosophy, you see. This is not moral philosophy. So there's a one chance in three that I go into work on a Friday. So he works it out. Now, that doesn't mean, because chance is involved, it's not certain, that doesn't mean that I go into work by accident, does it? You see? In other words, the fact that you can assign a probability to me going into work on a given day doesn't mean that there's no intelligent decision involved in going into work that day, do you see? And very often, people confuse those two. Chance is a causal explanation, is confused with the notion of design. They think that because chance is involved, there's no design involved. My watch will illustrate that in a simpler way. You know, the random motions of my arm wind it up. There is a chance element in it, but that doesn't mean it hasn't been designed. Also, in that decision to go to work, probably, I don't know enough about consciousness, nobody knows what it is, quantum mechanical events will be involved, which are inherently unpredictable, you see. So the point is, the first two types of chance are involved. The statistician says one chance in three. There are unpredictable quantum mechanical events going on. Nevertheless, it is still by design that I go in. And sometimes those are not clearly sorted out from one another. So we need to watch the word chance just a little bit. Well, there were three answers there, weren't there? So, to what question? Oh, chance doesn't cause things. not in that sense. They happen. But, for example, if a window breaks, and I say it happened by chance, what I actually mean is a wind suddenly blew. There were causes, you see. Yes, but it doesn't cause anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Well, is microevolution natural? Well, microevolution, again, is difficult to pin down in the sense that where are its limits and not limits. But just taking it on the simplest level, small changes, are they due to natural processes? I would have thought mostly, of course they are. For example, I see a girl. Well, I did long, many years ago. She became my wife. So I selected her. Natural selection, you know. I selected her. And we got married. Now, that's a very natural process, that attraction and so on and so forth. You see what I mean? And that has certain effects. She might be carrying a genetic disease, one-third of us do, caused by a mutation, you know. And it is the fact, medicine has revealed to us, I discuss it frequently with my colleagues, that mutations do happen in the natural processes of the replication of the DNA in our bodies as a natural process. Mostly, and this is a very interesting thing, mostly those mutations are deleterious. They have a highly negative effect, which is one of the reasons, one of the most eminent French biologist ever, Pierre Grasset, who was the president of l'Académie Française and the author, or the one who stood behind the huge encyclopedia of biology that's in France, a real heavyweight. He did not believe in macroevolution. And why? Because he'd done repeated experimentation on fruit flies inducing mutations, in other words, helping nature along by bombarding them with radiation, and found that they repeat their generations very frequently, and all he got was fruit flies and very damaged fruit flies. And that led to a colossal debate, because someone as eminent as Theodosius Dobzhansky, who took the opposite view, says, you've got to listen to Grasset. You know, you can disagree with him, but you've got to listen to him, because he is a real heavyweight. So there is a variability, and you'd expect, let me say, not you, but I would expect, you've got a big planet. And one of the things that the Creator does, as I see it, is build in a potential for variation, a certain elasticity in the creatures he places on this planet, so that they can adapt to certain things, and that's a very good thing. So natural processes, certainly, even from our perspective, unguided natural processes are in behind there somewhere. And it's very interesting that not all that long ago, I spoke to a fellow of the Royal Society in Britain, and I was introduced to him rather mischievously by a geneticist, and he said, "This is John Lennox, who does not believe in evolution." And the man's eyes started to open as if he'd seen his first dinosaur. And I jumped in very quickly and I said, "Now, come on, tell him it like it really is." Well, he said, "That's what it is. You don't believe in evolution." I said, "I haven't the slightest problem with what Darwin observed. The variations of finchbeaks and so on, you see, which actually, if you study them, are not even examples of microevolution, but cyclic variation. But that doesn't matter. I have no problem with that. Where I have real problem is innovation, increase of information." I didn't say any more, because the friend who is a fellow of the Royal Society, academic in the Russian sense, said, "But that's what I believe." And the geneticist said, "What, you too?" Yes, he said, "I should have thought it was obvious by now that the Darwinian mechanism cannot account for major innovation." He said, don't ask me what the answer is, but that it isn't mutation and natural selection, I should have thought was obvious. And the first man was so amazed when he said, I'd better be honest then. And I said, what, you too? And he said, yes. He said, I was asked recently by two of Europe's leading biologists, did I believe in evolution? And I had to say to them, I don't know anymore. I find curious things are happening in some people's minds, not everybody's minds. Yes, please. You can agree with me as much as you like, yes.
I like what you said, I really enjoyed it.
But.
The inference from lots of scientists don't agree that natural selection mutations can cause what we're seeing today, but I don't agree with the inference from that backwards to say that God miraculously placed the species on the earth.
Yes.
I mean, that's a belief that anyone can hold, but it's a belief just as much as an American belief that nature.
Yes, sure, yes.
So, I'm not sure that is as good an argument for a creator as the intelligence we see in.
Oh, I think I do, yes. I never claimed it was. The point is, it depends who you're talking to and what you're talking about. The mathematicians are much more interested in things like this, and I happen to be a mathematician. I apologize for that, you see. I think we need to retain a sense of proportion. And the basic biblical statements are the ones that guide me on this. Paul says that there is evidence in creation that there is a God and that he's powerful. He doesn't say there is evidence for fellows of the Royal Society and experts in science and so on. It's for everybody. So there's that basic perception in the glory of it all. That's the first argument. And the reason I dealt with the other arguments first is that we must not lose a sense of proportion in talking just about the detail as if everything depended on the detail. Remember what I said to you. I do think Dawkins is committing a category mistake, so that my theism, my belief in God, does not depend on the answer to the question we're talking about here. God is capable of subtly guiding. He can do it any way he likes. In a sense, it's up to science to determine how or how not he did. But the reason why I'm a great skeptic here is because this is the only area of science that is deducible from a philosophy without any evidence whatsoever. Yeah, but can I explain that? In the ancient world, Lucretius, who was an Epicurean philosopher, got everything Darwin got except the transmutation of species. And he deduced it straight from atomistic philosophy. So that you can deduce, if you are a materialist in your inner conviction, then, and you're given a piece of paper and asked to say, how did life arise? You will come up with an evolutionary theory. Now, there's no other area of science I know of where you can do that. You can't get Newton's laws out of any philosophy that I know. And this is where it gets difficult. Because if the dominant philosophy of academia is materialism, then any questioning of a physical theory that is directly deducible from that materialism will be a very difficult game to play, as I've discovered. So that's another thing to factor in. I'm not proving anything with that. I'm just observing it. That's right.
So it's a similar idea. I don't think there's any reason to reject the idea of religion. It came from philosophy. I mean, I think as a molecular, as a biologist, I could see the relations between species. And on that ground,
yeah.
I could say, That's right.
That's right, and we've got to ask what the evidence is, but that isn't what I was saying. What I was saying is that your example is superb, actually, Because the interesting thing about Copernicus is he was still applying Aristotle's canon that perfection is circular. So you take that notion of and you impose it on the universe. Whereas Kepler said, let's look and actually see what's happening. And there came a turning point in the history of science where Kepler decided to go with the evidence and not with the imposed philosophy. The difficulty is all science thrives on being questioned. This is the only area of science that I've ever heard a Nobel Prize winner say, you mustn't question it. That's very dangerous, whether it's right or wrong. Oh, of course there is. Absolutely. I agree with you. Yes, they do. I think we're going to have to do something here. I'm being threatened from the back. Is our time up? Oh, our time. What's a pity. We're just getting going.
The last 5 minutes for myself. I have a question and a question on standing by the door. Thank you all for coming. I'm sure we all learned a lot of different things.
While we're sitting in the seat, can I ask you a question?
That's right. But what you say in the forum mustn't depend on the answer to this question. Well, that's a very interesting question. It's quite an explosive question, that one, in fact. Repeat it out loud.
I was asking if there's any difference between a materialist philosophy, which says that what we see is all there is, and a deist philosophy that says there is a God, but he doesn't
exist. You see, that's a very interesting question, and I get this from people like Richard Dawkins, not him personally, but people have said to me something like this. You know, if I simply stop at the first stage of the argument, I say, look, existence of mechanism does not imply absence of agency. They say, well, that's a lovely argument, but look, isn't it obvious? You believe in God. God is so clever, is he, that he is completely obliterated all traces of his existence. Well, he's superfluous, you see. So you're right. There is a sense in which it comes perilously close to that. And I don't want to be labeled a deist, so I would want to preface my remarks by saying two things. What Scripture reveals, and now we're getting onto Scripture, I'm using it through this lens, is that there is such a thing as Shabbat. And that is striking. What strikes me about Genesis 1 is the simple things about it. One, I've been saying this on another occasion, but I'll say it very quickly now, that there is a finite set of creation events, not just one, but more than one, and they stop. Now, if I'd been writing this account, I'd have expected there just to be one. But there isn't just one. But there's a limited number. That's very interesting, I find. So it relates to your previous question. Now, the second thing is, therefore, the implication of that is you have to distinguish between creation and maintenance or providence and upholding. The deist says God started it and withdrew. The Christian doesn't say that. The Christian says there are two. At least two dimensions, and there are probably three or four actually, but two dimensions of the relationship of God to the universe. The one is as creator and author. He creates it. It didn't exist. It does exist. Life didn't exist on it. Life now exists. And so on. And the striking thing is there are only four or five of those interventions. Six. Then God upholds it. Not creating anymore, actually. You see. So I find it useful to say that. Because often one is accused of what people call semi-deism, that you have God not just doing once and letting it go, but doing a few times and letting it go. No. Right? Does that make some sort of sense? Yes.
But I think the point is, if as you as you said, that there's a finite number of interventions, then once he's carried out his after intervention, you can't distinguish between that and deism.
Yeah, but we want to be careful with the word intervention itself, as if God is an intruder. I think we need to reformulate the vocabulary here. The rhetoric is very important because intervention carries a very negative connotation of people. You see, an interference even worse. And you get this notion that God is almost a prisoner of his own laws. But this is absurd. This is the Creator building a universe. He ain't intervening in anything. He's building it, you see. But the fact is, from our perspective, it looks like steps of existence where there was no existence before. I wouldn't call that intervention. Although it's very hard to know what a word is. And the interesting thing is you've got two things happening. You've got regularity. And then if there were no regularity, if there were no laws of nature, we would never recognize a miracle. A miracle doesn't break laws of nature, C.S. Lewis pointed out clearly long ago. God feeds a new event in. And the very fact that it's a new event is recognized because we know what normally happens. And if something happens that doesn't normally happen, it's our knowledge of the regularities that helps us to recognize it, you see. If we're what? Old. I am very old, yes. Oh, if we're old earthers. Uh-huh. What's the point you're making?
You're saying that if creation describes all the changes and then God stopped, then we haven't had a chance to observe.
Oh, I never claimed we had observed it. But that raises another question as to the authority of the documents that describe it. Whether we've observed it or not. That's another question. And you said I was an old earther. How do you know that?
I don't know.
You just presumed it, did you? Well, you see, we're going to have a discussion about that tomorrow. I certainly concede that I am old, but you'll find out tomorrow. Okay, thank you very much.